WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Bush administration has adopted a new policy that will allow the U.S. to act more rigorously in hostage cases. Tonight's guest says this policy will not prevent kidnappings and may even put Americans traveling abroad at risk. We begin with another Washington story, the Pentagon's proposed new information plan. In repudiation of an article that ran in yesterday's New York Times, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said today, quote, "The Pentagon does not issue disinformation to the foreign press or any press." But Pentagon officials are still negotiating how the new Office of Strategic Influence will manage information to aid U.S. armed forces in the war on terror. Tom Ricks is military correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him if this new propaganda policy will fly.
No. To use a crude expression, I see this as the equivalent of peeing in the pool.
Peeing in the pool.
Yeah, I think what's going on here is the people who lead the Pentagon really dislike leaks in all forms. Rumsfeld has said to my face that he would like to prosecute people who leak to me. And I think kind of what they're saying here is, if you can't beat them, let's join them. Let's actually, you know, throw dye or something else into the pool of information. Let's color it. And I think that's what they were discussing. Now, remember, this is not a Pentagon policy at this point. There are a lot of people at the Pentagon who oppose it. Mm-hmm. I think it's highly unlikely that this will ever be approved.
And the leak of this, presumably by opponents, right?
Yes, that's right.
And it has had the effect that the opponents want, which is we're talking about it right now with widening incredulity on the radio.
Exactly. The problem here is that information warfare has been a new and growing part of the U.S. military for about the last 10 years. It's in an era when there wasn't a whole lot of money floating around in the military, when the budgets felt tight to the people in the military. There was one place where you could always make sure you got money by calling whatever you're doing information warfare. Mm-hmm. It was a real growth stock in the military establishment. The problem is now the info warriors are looking around for what do we actually do. And they're saying, well, let's do information. We'll have a czar over information who will control both the white world, the so-called white world of public affairs and media relations, and the black world of covert operations. One Svengali or Wizard of Oz behind the screen manipulating both of those outlets. Will it work? I don't think so. But also, I tried to make the point in my story today that the people who seem to be in charge of this at the Pentagon, of cooking up this policy, are not information specialists. They're not people experienced in shaping public opinion. They are data movers. General Warden, the head of this new so-called Office of Strategic Influence, is an astrophysicist by trade. He knows a whole lot about missile defense. He comes out of the Office of Strategic Defense Initiative, the old SDI Star Wars office. Which doesn't seem to me a track record of really impressing a lot of the American public.
At bottom here, there's a kind of contempt for the role of the press, it sounds like.
I think so, in a real underestimation of the pliability of public opinion mm-hmm. and the public mm-hmm. information. This goes back to something that's irked me about the Pentagon approach to this war since late September, which is imitating our adversary and closing down information. Mm-hmm. I think in war, as in sports, you go with your strengths. And the American strengths are transparency, the free flow of information. Mm-hmm. What connects a democracy and the free market is that in both cases, information is supposed to flow freely. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon's reaction in defending our free market democracy has been to shut down the flow of information as much as possible. And I think this is just one more stumble on that sorry path.
Mm. Apparently, they've been frustrated by reports of civilian casualties and the use of disproportionate force in Afghanistan. But if that's the case, they've been frustrated by the truth, haven't they?
Sure, but you got to remember where they're coming from. Their attitude is, look, you're arguing in a war about a few hundred civilian casualties. The U.S. Air Force, in one night at the end of World War II, killed about 80,000 people when it bombed Tokyo. So and their perspective is, in terms of air wars, this is the most precise ever. If we can topple a regime and only kill a few hundred people, that's a very precise war. And the Air Force was genuinely startled by the media emphasis on civilian casualties.
Another part of this proposal is to send journalists and civic leaders and foreign leaders emails, sort of fake emails that will promote American views without identifying where they're from.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to really scare us. If you don't listen to us, we'll spam you to death. The sad thing is, you could have taken an entirely different and very American approach to this whole situation back in September. And I know people in special forces who advocated this. Be totally open. Be as transparent as possible. You're proud of what you're doing. You think you're doing the right thing. Show the world. Put a reporter in the back of strike aircraft when you go out and drop bombs. There are reporters in much better shape than me, like my colleague on the Pentagon, Pete, at the Washington Post, Vernon Loeb, who's a marathon runner. Drop him in with the Rangers. Mm-hmm. Let him parachute in. Show everything. And instead, they went with their knee-jerk sort of instincts, which is, let's shut down everything as much as possible, which is a very un-American way of going about it, and I think it's ultimately doomed to fail.
And this is Secretary Rumsfeld. He has a fetish, doesn't he, about leaks, and as you say. And
remember that one of the first things Rumsfeld did after September 11th, like 2 days later, was quite ferociously denounce leaks.
I remember that.
As if leaks had somehow caused the World Trade Center attack.
Mm. Maureen Dowd in today's Times raises the obvious point. She says, well, wait a minute. We don't have to exaggerate the wickedness of these terrorists. Why do we need, it's already done. The facts are bad enough.
Exactly. It reminded me of once I was talking to a Marine captain in Somalia, in Mogadishu, back in 1992. And he started criticizing something in the media. And then he looked at me and he said, well, now I guess you can tell me where to put my machine guns. He at least had a sense of irony. When you make the Pentagon press critics, that's about as good as letting reporters try to design your battles for you.
Mm. Of course, there's a precedent for this, and it's kind of a dark one. The CIA throughout the Cold War sponsored disinformation campaigns and even sponsored groups abroad and magazines abroad, unbeknownst to the readers of those magazines. I think of Encounter, which, by the way, was an outstanding magazine, but pretty much backed by the CIA.
The taxpayers' money well spent. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and there have one reason I think the Pentagon sort of wandered into this and was kind of surprised by the reaction was they have nibbled away at this. For example, Delta Force, the most secret of the special operations units. Mm-hmm. I have been told that some Delta people have disguised themselves as reporters in the past, in Somalia, for example. This is an extremely dangerous thing because when I go into a battlefield as a reporter, I am not armed.
Mm.
And if people think I might be Delta, then they're going to shoot first and ask questions later.
And your former colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Daniel Pearl, is...
Danny Pearl is currently kidnapped somewhere in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Remember also, 8 reporters died in the Afghan war.
Mm.
There was a spell there when it was about an average of 1 a week. So things that confuse boundaries, that blur the line between intelligence and media operations.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that should be debated hotly and in public before anything happens. And one thing that strikes me is the Pentagon has not been willing to publicly debate its information operations to discuss what it wants to do.
Tom Ricks is military correspondent for The Washington Post. From now on, all kidnappings of Americans abroad will be examined by a government panel. This is a new policy coming out of a study begun in the Clinton administration and completed in recent months under Bush, even before the Daniel Pearl case made headline news. Whether for cash or cause, Americans abroad are a target. And now, the hostage subgroup led by the National Security Council will review every case of hostage taking. It will involve the government in decision-making for negotiation or military action. Previously, the government only became involved if the American concerned was an American official or a member of the armed services. So, is this just a good thing? Doesn't this prima facie make you feel safer in traveling abroad? Or was there a reason previous American governments trod more cautiously in this area? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Gary Weaver, professor of international communications and executive director of the Intercultural Management Institute at American University. Welcome, Gary Weaver.
Good to be here.
With me here in the studio is tonight's news analyst, Jyoti Puri. She is professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. Welcome, Jyoti.
Good evening, Jack.
Let's start with you, Gary Weaver. This
what's intuitively, this just seems absolutely right. And in the war on terrorism, it has a context that I think every American can understand. There's now a new sort of threat to American travelers abroad. The government wants to deter their kidnapping, their hostage taking. This new policy, which says, in effect, hey, you take one of our guys, civilian, military, connected with the government or not, and you could get the commandos down your chimney or a cruise missile down your chimney tomorrow. Doesn't this just deter hostage taking abroad? And isn't this just part of the defense that American travelers need in the age of terror?
No, as a matter of fact, it may make it a little bit more dangerous. Probably, I don't know, 80-90% of all hostage situations overseas involve ransom. And this, the only motive is money. It's not terrorism. It's not political and so forth. And therefore, very quietly, professionals who provide insurance will often try to negotiate a release and a ransom because the idea is you don't want anybody to get killed. It is not in the hostage taker's benefit, advantage to kill a hostage because the hostage is money. It's a hot potato. And therefore, as with the movie Proof of Life, these professionals often really know their business. They know the local culture. They do their homework. They try to work through local people. But the whole goal is to save someone's life. Now, if the purpose is deterrence, then what you're going to do is come down very hard. And clearly, we're not going to send in the troops when somebody kidnaps a businessman in Mexico City, some cab driver, some person who just wants to make a couple thousand bucks. I mean, this is the average type of hostage situation. I think while it sounds reasonable that you would threaten to use force, in fact, everybody knows you're not going to use force unless it's politically motivated or the local government isn't going to do anything or there's no other recourse. So I don't think this is going to deter hostage taking. And in fact, it may make it a little bit more dangerous because at this point, you eliminate the quiet negotiations that ought to take place behind the scenes. Mm.
Jyoti Puri, are you going to feel safer traveling abroad, knowing that your government will be behind you should you be, God forbid, kidnapped?
Well, in some ways, yes. And I think I say that as, you know, to the extent that we extend this kind of protection to government officials, for example. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibilities that why shouldn't individual citizens be protected as well? On the other hand, I mean, I think I can, you know, I'm very skeptical of this approach. So I want to say that, yes, there are some good reasons why it might be important to protect individual citizens, but I think it is a slippery slope, and I think that's what Gary Weaver is also asking us to think about.
And the slippery slope leads to?
I think, you know, one of the things I wonder is that once this becomes overt policy, to what extent are just average American citizens who are traveling, to what extent are they going to become more vulnerable?
Because their value will increase.
Exactly. It's upping the ante, basically. And so I think there's the question about people becoming more vulnerable. I think what Gary Weaver has just pointed out in terms of the complication of the negotiation. So I think, you know, I think there are some, I think that would be the slippery slope. And I think also there is this sort of, to me, it sounds also like heightened militarization in some ways. So now it's that each citizen becomes protected and that the state, the entire force of the state, technically, I know it's probably not going to happen, but technically the entire force of the American state is behind each and every citizen. I just don't see how that is enforceable.
As if that citizen were a soldier or a government official.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if I can just add to that.
Hold on to that, Gary. We're just going to pause here. We'll come right back to you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about how to make the world safe for American travelers this hour in the context of President Bush's new policy of involving the United States government in hostage takings abroad. Does that make you feel safer? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before the break, Gary Weaver, you were responding to something that Jyoti Puri had said about that this policy seems to make the citizen a kind of soldier.
Well, I agree. And ultimately, you know, let's say some gangster in Chicago holds a Canadian hostage and wants money. Are the Canadians going to land the troops? Of course not. I mean, you'd want to work through the local government. You'd want to negotiate quietly behind the scenes. And clearly there are limits. I mean, while it may be possible to land troops when an American diplomat is taken hostage, that could be reasonable. If the local government won't cooperate, I think it's highly unlikely we would ever land troops. And furthermore, I think the best way to prevent this kind of situation is educating people on how not to become a hostage. I mean, to avoid those situations where you can become a hostage.
Could you give us a primer on that? How do you avoid it?
Sure. Well, hostage taking is very seldom random, overseas at least. I think in many cases they watch the person to find out what route the person would take to work every day and so forth. And if you don't vary your route, then clearly you're going to be targeted to be a hostage. So why not know that there's a possibility you're going to be taken hostage and avoid those situations? I think that would be where we ought to be devoting our energy rather than threatening to land troops and so forth, because I don't think that's going to deter most people.
Hmm. We're joined now on the line by Armando Lara. He was the director of operations. He is the director of operations at Control Risk Group, a leading international business risk consultancy firm. And he's the former director of the FBI in Colombia, where he dealt with hostage situations. Welcome to you, Mr. Lara.
Thank you, Jack.
Now, in the Times story the other day, they instanced a South American kidnapping that sounded like a paradigm of what the government wants to do in future cases. It's the kidnapping of a man named Ronald Sander. Can you tell us about that?
Very honestly, Jack, I'm not quite familiar with that particular matter.
Okay. All right. Well, what it really was that he was an oil executive who was kidnapped and the ransom was paid and our government followed the ransom and got 57 of the people who had perpetrated the kidnapping. Unfortunately, Mr. Sander died. You have dealt on the ground with this kind of thing, Mr. Lara, would a threat of government involvement have helped you in the past in dealing with some of these cases?
No, neither, very honestly, with the FBI nor with Control Risk Group that we would seek any type of active military intervention. I agree with the comments of your previous guests, and especially with Gary, mentioning that it would actually cause a greater danger to the victim. And Jack might have mentioned that actually I'm not quite clear as to why the government has decided to form this council, this group, because the FBI already has the mandate under the hostage taking statute, a law that's on the book that says that the FBI will investigate these matters if a U.S. citizen is taken hostage. So I just see another layer of bureaucracy here that mm-hmm. could only muddy the waters as in trying to resolve these situations.
So you, as an FBI agent, have been involved in dealing with the kidnapping of private citizens abroad and trying to get them out. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us a sort of specimen story of how you proceed?
Well, the recent movie, Proof of Life, mm-hmm. with Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan, that case occurred when I was directing the FBI in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. And what was that case?
Pardon me?
Well, I'm just asking, what was that case?
It was the kidnapping of a agricultural scientist, a U.S. citizen, from Cali, Colombia, and he was held for a year by the Colombian insurgent group, and eventually was released after a ransom was paid. Now, in that case, and as in virtually all the others, any attempt to rescue by force would have resulted in the death of the hostage, as occurred in other cases in which the Colombian military has tried to actively extract the person, mm-hmm. and the hostage faces a greater chance of being killed in those instances.
Well, what were you doing on the ground in the FBI?
With the FBI, we would help the family understand what was the situation, provide the type of advice to the extent that the FBI can. But again, the U.S. government has a position of not negotiating with terrorists, and they do classify the two of the Colombian insurgent groups as terrorist organizations, and those two groups carry out the majority of the kidnappings in that country. So we will work with the family, provide them advice, but it reaches a point where we can go no further, mm-hmm. and we have to step back and really let groups as organizations as Control Risk Group, with whom I am mm-hmm. employed now, to negotiate the matter and to bring out the person safely.
Mm-hmm. And it says, are you implying that one of the dangers of this new policy is that we might be drawn into negotiating with terrorists?
I don't see the government being drawn in to negotiate. I see the government maybe wanting to go in with force in order to resolve the situation, because the government is not going to negotiate. Mm-hmm. What I also fear is that people will not report kidnappings to the government for fear that the government will involve the military. This, in fact, happened in Colombia from the years 1993 to 95. The payment of ransom was outlawed in Colombia. You could not do it under the law. You would be prosecuted. And the whole purpose was to then convince kidnappers that this was not a profitable business if no one could pay. But, of mm-hmm. course, what happened, as what one might expect, is that families did not report the kidnappings to the government because their concern was the release of their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I could see the same thing happening in this if a U.S. company had a person kidnapped in a foreign country, the Philippines, Colombia, Venezuela, the Middle East, that they would might not go to the U.S. Embassy and report it for fear that the military would become involved, because their primary concern is to get the person out alive.
So rather than deterring the kidnappers, it would deter the citizens from asking the government for help.
Exactly. Exactly what happened in Colombia, mm-hmm. where they actually mm-hmm. had a process in place.
Well, if, as you say, the FBI is already somewhat involved in this, why this new policy? Is it for real, or is this just a public relations exercise trying to give Americans a little more confidence in traveling abroad?
Well, it would, to me, at this point, without knowing further details, seem to be the latter. In other words, that it's cosmetic, mm-hmm. that it is trying to demonstrate that the U.S. government is doing something in relation to kidnapping of U.S. citizens. But there's a very well-developed system in place with the FBI, with how they go about handling these matters, mm-hmm. how the FBI will work closely with organizations as Control Risk Group in order to bring about a resolution of the matter with the safe release of the individual, mm-hmm. and at the same time hopefully achieving the law enforcement objectives of identifying the individuals responsible,
right,
indicting them and prosecuting them.
Mm-hmm. Gary Weaver, there's an insurance mm-hmm. angle to this too, isn't there?
Well, sure. I mean, Armando works for a company that provides insurance, and most major companies operating overseas, even some universities, provide kidnap and ransom insurance. And this is simply to be sure that if one would get kidnapped, you're going to have a professional organization come in, bring in their negotiators with the object in mind of freeing the individual who's been kidnapped. And the insurance can run as high as $1 million per person. It's fairly inexpensive for the organization, but it does provide some resource to turn to if kidnapping should take place, with very experienced people who know what they're doing, like Armando.
And is this just a routine part of employer-employee contracts? I've never heard of it.
I mean, I would ask Armando to chime in, but I find that most large companies that I've worked with over the last few years, it's just routine. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you don't make a big deal out of it because otherwise you're going to encourage kidnapping.
Of course.
So you have to low-key it. But it's just one of those benefits that you'd want your employees to have overseas if they're in high-risk areas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would agree with Gary's comments, but it certainly is something that a company does not advertise, but it's just like having fire insurance on your house. You don't expect it to happen. You hope your house will never burn down, but nevertheless, you have that type of coverage. And it's the same with working in complex or hostile environments, that you need to really have this type of insurance.
Sure. Jyoti?
I wonder if both Gary Weaver and Armando Lara could help put into perspective what is the scale that we are talking about. I mean, both of them are talking about people working abroad, but I'm also thinking about just people who travel. You know, especially in the post-September 11, there's this sort of heightened sense of insecurity. So to what extent is also this conversation really making people feel even more insecure about hostage taking and even more reluctant to travel in a way that might have existed before this? So I think it might be even helpful to put this into perspective, is what is the scale at which we're, at?
Gary Weaver?
Well, first of all, I think it's very rare. I don't think it's that common. And usually a hostage taker who's motivated for financial gain is going to go after somebody who's got a lot of money, not the average tourist. In fact, there's a hostage situation in the Philippines right now involving two missionaries and by Abu Sayyaf down in the southern part. And I was down there a couple months ago. And this particular missionary group refuses to pay a ransom. So this was a real mistake, because I think the primary motive down there is to get money to perhaps finance the rebel movement. And here you've got two hostages who you're not going to get any money out of. So for the average tourist, we don't find hostage takers that are that stupid that would do that. I mean, generally, they know who they're going after. Or in the case of a journalist, they may feel that somehow this will give them some good publicity for their cause, and also they might have demands about releasing, members of their own group. All of this is to say, I don't think the average tourist ought to be overly concerned. On the other hand, the State Department will tell you, don't go to this part of Sri Lanka today because there have been incidents where rebels have taken hostage. So you can, if you do your homework, it's very unlikely that you could ever be taken hostage, but Armando would know more about this.
I agree with Gary. The traveler very rarely gets kidnapped. Yes, the traveler may be exposed to what they call the express kidnappings, or the ATM, where they scoop you up off a street corner in Mexico City and take you to an ATM and make you take withdraw money to your limit, and maybe they'll stuff you in the trunk and keep you overnight and take you back again to make another withdrawal. But that's not really a typical kidnap for ransom. So the traveler, really, we have not seen the traveler face any greater exposure than prior to 9/11, nor have we seen, other than the Daniel Pearl incident, really political type kidnappings with political demands, as we saw during the late 80s and into the early 90s with Hezbollah and Hamas.
Sure. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim is on the line, and Jim, I apologize for making you wait so long.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if I might be able to inject perhaps a little bit more balance to the program. If I understand correctly, based on the statements made by your guests thus far, I believe all three of the individuals that you have on your show sound as if they are against this new government policy of the government injecting themselves into hostage type situations. And, the question I have is, it sounds like a lot of the statements that have been made thus far are based on data which largely is comprised of pre-9/11 data. Mm-hmm. I think Gary made the statement something like 80 to 90% of all hostage situations are kind of money-based, where the hostage takers are looking for money in return for the return of the hostage. And I wonder if really we have enough data to go off of post 9/11 to kind of have a more complete understanding of what the nature of hostage taking will be like in the future.
Yeah, that was I asked something like that of Gary Weaver right out of the box, that there's a new aureole around us now, and that is the war on terror. And you can even imagine, Jim, can't you, that there could be ransom kidnapping by terrorists as a fundraising device.
Sure, that's certainly the case. And you know, that crowd might need to be dealt with in a different way than you would perhaps your run-of-the-day hostage taker, if there is such a thing.
Right, and possibly in investigating it, the government could get valuable intelligence. Gary Weaver, do you want to respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Jim's quite right. I haven't seen any data that suggests that it has been increasing. And as I said, I was in the Philippines when the American's head was found. They kidnapped an American and cut off his head. And everybody was very tense, and I certainly had security with me. But there were no other incidents after that. So Jim may be quite right. I mean, we might see a dramatic increase, but so far, this hasn't been true, as far as I know.
Armando, what are you telling your clients, your executive clients, post September 11th?
Well, to review their security procedures, to look at what they have in place. Is it cosmetic, or does it actually work? Is it what Gary had mentioned earlier about educating the travelers and your expatriates that live in these countries to help identify when there is a threat, to minimize and lower their profile so that the kidnappers will actually go to the harder target or to the softer targets. Kidnappers are just like any other type of criminal. Mm-hmm. They want to go to the soft target, the one that doesn't have the defenses in place, that does not have a security profile. And so I believe that what we're spending a lot of time now on is training those executives that are living in those difficult environments and traveling in those complex environments as to how to stay safe. That's what we're finding as the best approach.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point, and we'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about how to make the world safe for American travelers this hour.
University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our subject is the new Bush policy of involving the federal government, in all its branches and possibilities, in hostage-taking abroad. Our guest, Gary Weaver, is professor of international communications at American University. Armando Lara, he's the former director of the FBI in Colombia, and our guest news analyst, Jyoti Puri of Simmons College in Boston. Stephen is on the line. Stephen, I apologize to you to keeping you waiting. Welcome. Stephen? Hello, Stephen.
Yes, I'm here.
Great.
Jack, I'm alarmed by how cavalierly your guests are talking about paying ransom. I suppose they're going to call me naive, but I think there's a reason why the U.S. government and the Israeli government and probably other governments have policies against paying ransom and negotiating with terrorists, and that's that the very existence of the kind of insurance you're talking about and of the negotiating teams you're describing is the thing that encourages the taking of the hostages in the first place. If there were no availability of ransom money, there would be no reason to abduct these people in looking for money.
So this is kind of an industry you're suggesting.
Yes.
Armando Lara, your response?
Well, you might have to consider that in the United States, the government has no position. The government takes no position against payment of ransom in kidnapping cases. In fact, it's used as an investigative tool. So in the United States, the government says, yes, it's okay. It doesn't take any position. It does not oppose it. But it finds that it has the right to say that in foreign countries, you cannot pay a terrorist or a kidnapper a ransom. So there's a disconnect right there.
Okay, so I disagree with the policy. That doesn't change the fact that the availability of the ransom money itself encourages the taking of the hostages.
Well, but what the reality is, as we saw in Colombia for a three-year period, is that the people, to better ensure the release of their loved ones, then simply did not report it to the government because the government had passed a law saying you could not pay, and they would freeze your assets so you could not have access to your own funds. And the Constitutional Court ruled against it because it found it unconstitutional. And people would not go to the government. They would not report kidnappings. They would find a way to secure the release of their loved ones without involvement of the government.
And presumably, even absent this insurance, people would raise the money themselves, or companies would just give people the money directly.
Exactly. That's exactly what has happened.
Another
point. About one-third, I think, of all kidnappings that take place every year actually happen here in the U.S. And I agree with Armando. I mean, if it's a loved one and you want your loved one back alive, I mean, you're willing to pay a reasonable amount of money. But the more important point I want to make here is that all the hostage negotiators, including the FBI, that has a very large team, they're very experienced, will tell you that domestically, at least 88-89% of all the hostage situations were resolved with no one getting killed simply by negotiating. So to take the position, we will not negotiate, we will not talk ransom, isn't really rational, given the statistics that I'm telling you right now. And so clearly, I think even the government realizes that when someone is taken hostage or kidnapped, not for political reason but for ransom, that negotiations may actually save someone's life. Now, they don't want to do it because we don't want the government held hostage. But as an individual, of course, I think behind the scenes this has been going on. And to a certain extent, the Bush policy maybe has merit in saying we're just, certifying what has been done in practice to a certain extent. That is, the government and the negotiators are going to work together a little bit.
Yeah. You say that the government doesn't like to negotiate with terrorists. And, of course, in a famous case they did in the Reagan administration with the arms to the Iran-Contra affair.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was a case of President Reagan simply being moved by the plight of the American hostages in Lebanon, wasn't it? He just said, well, we've got to do something about these people. Yeah. Let's take a call. Simon is on the line. Thank you for your call, Jim.
Yes. Before the Terry Anderson, Father Janko, and the rest of the Americans being held in Lebanon, before that deal went down with the Iran-Contra scandal and all that, the U.S. government had dealt Nicholas Danilov to get him back, a journalist, for the Russian Zakharov, if you remember.
Yeah.
And the Israelis previously had traded thousands of people that they had picked up in Lebanon for a handful of their soldiers that had been kidnapped up in Lebanon. And so the idea to have Terry Anderson go on morning television and say, Danny Pearl, there should be no deal for him, you know, unlike there was a deal for Terry Anderson. I just think that the unevenness, the hypocrisy, the double standards, has given me a headache. Mm. You know, the government of the United States saying we will not deal with, with terrorists, and you saw Reagan making that statement as well. I mean, you know, they do it. You can negotiate anything if you believe, you know, that Harvard professor wrote the book on that. You can negotiate anything. I just wanted to close by saying that I think that there should have been some kind of a deal for Danny Pearl, at least to discuss it, to talk with them. And I don't think there's any harm in trying to talk. You know, less war, more jaw, sort of, you know. And what do you guys think?
We take your point, Gary Weaver.
Well, I agree with him. I think there's nothing to be lost by talking. I think cutting off a conversation once a hostage has been taken could actually be very, very dangerous. It doesn't mean you pay ransom or you're rewarding the behavior, but to take a flat policy, we will not negotiate with hostage takers, I definitely wouldn't agree with.
Joshi,
yeah, Jack, if I might.
Armando, yes.
As Gary had mentioned earlier, the two missionaries in the Philippines, they are belong to the New Tribes Mission group out of Sanford, Florida. And during my tenure in Colombia, five of their missionaries were killed.
Oh, and this is a group that will not give ransom.
Correct.
Yes.
And so one has to look at this whole issue of not wanting to negotiate and not trying to find some middle ground. And we can certainly point to what happened in Colombia to five other missionaries of that same organization in Colombia. And there's now five widows.
Joji Perry?
Jack, I think if we think back about what has just been said, both by Armando Lara as well as Gary Weaver, the callers, it seems to me if we start to put the pieces together that there is a real tension here. In some ways, what I'm hearing is that nothing has really changed because the FBI, I think Armando Lara pointed it out early on, has been involved. I mean, the caller just pointed that out as well. So it seems like nothing has really changed. And on the other hand, it's interesting that this is a timing for taking a very overt, explicit position, even though both the guests are saying that there's really no need to take that kind of explicit position because, if anything, it's going to muddy the waters. Armando Lara used the word cosmetic a couple of times. So in some ways, this sort of tension really, I think it really raises the question, so what is, in fact, new about this? Why this timing now? And is this just really a PR effort then in order to create a sense of security and possibly a false sense of security? And at the same time, is this going to really allow for greater intervention by, covertly at least, greater intervention by the FBI or other groups who might be in a position to then, quote-unquote, attack the terrorist cell, whoever the terrorists are, and depending on your definition of the terrorists.
Yeah, of course, Armando Lara, it sounds like a new policy. Here's an official saying, summing up. He says, the bottom line is if you take an American hostage, even if they pay ransom, you will never benefit. You will be found and prosecuted. That's it. That's something new, isn't it?
Well, the mission of the FBI and under the hostage taking statute has always been to identify and prosecute the individuals. In fact, there are several individuals in Ecuador who have been indicted and will be eventually extradited to the United States to stand trial for the kidnapping of several U.S. citizens going back a year ago. So that process has already been underway, and that's ultimately when I was with the FBI in Colombia, that was always our goal, to work for the release of the individual, but simultaneously identify those responsible to see if we could bring indictments against them and have them then extradited or prosecuted in the local courts or extradited back to the United States. My concern about this new structure is that it'll only further complicate the very difficult mandate and charter that the FBI has under the hostage-taking statute.
Yeah. So in other words, already we've been doing this. This is just sort of announcing what's been standard operating procedure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
And therefore it raises the question, Jyoti says, of whether this is a sheer cosmetic exercise or I can see, though, the logic of intelligence gathering here. Isn't there some of that? I mean, if there's hostage taking, if the people taking hostage have political motivations, if they are connected in some way, as in the Philippines, with Al-Qaeda, don't you want the government talking to the private entities involved? Don't you want the CIA and the FBI finding out everything they can about this sort of to follow the sort of path of the terrorist network? Isn't this part of the, as someone said earlier, the war on terror?
Well, this is Armando. That already happens. That's already in place.
That's already happening.
Every kidnap I ever worked in Colombia with the FBI, we involved the CIA, we involved the NSA, we involved the State Department. There was meetings on possibly a weekly basis, depending upon the case, to exchange intelligence, to determine where is the person being held, how are they being treated, what conversations have been intercepted. So all of that is already in place and ongoing.
So this does sort of underline, again, the cosmetic quality of this, our public relations quality. Gary Weaver?
Yeah, I think the danger, the greatest danger, which Armando mentioned earlier, is the fear that a family member might have that once I contact the embassy or let the FBI, CIA know what's going on, they're going to be trying to land troops or something of that sort, and that will only make the situation worse, and my loved one would get killed, and therefore I want to keep this hush-hush and not get the U.S. government involved. If that is the result of this new policy, then, of course, it is counterproductive. It doesn't give you the intelligence and the information that you're talking about.
I see
about.
What you're saying, yeah, yeah. Armando Lara, Gary Weaver, when he went to the Philippines, had an armed escort. Is that the future of executive travel in the third world?
Well, certainly with the area that Gary was going to, into the southern Philippines, yes, that's a requirement. But and I would have an armed escort, too, if I was going to the area he was in.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to measure. We work closely with our executives to measure what is the threat, what do they need to be safe, and then go from there. And if it's at such a high level, danger level, we'll tell them don't go or wait until another time when the threat level has gone down if you absolutely have to go at some point. So we closely work with them and sizing up what is the threat.
I can imagine a reluctant executive, please don't send me.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Gary Weaver is professor of international communications at American University. Armando Lara is the director of operation at Control Risks Group, a leading international business risk consultancy firm. He was the former director of the FBI in Colombia. Jyoti Puri, what do you make of all this? So you're not reassured, but on the other hand, you think we need to be reassured.
Well, I think that's the thing. That's the thing that I question, the fact that we are being reassured. And the question is, what are we being reassured about?
Mm.
So clearly, most people are not at risk at all in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, what they said. It's fairly rare for, you know, an average tourist to be kidnapped. Some of the high security areas where you really need to be careful, clearly people like Armando Lara already there sort of thinking about all of that. So the question then becomes, in terms of to what extent is this a feel-good stance? And, you know, what... I think I'm sort of leaning toward the position that this is really about taking a public stance, reassuring the American public that we are standing behind you, yet clearly it's not, you know, really enforceable. It's going to complicate and muddy a lot of the things. And it seems to be going by way of that larger effort to remake the image. I mean, I think there's an interesting parallel between this and the Office of Strategic Influence. I mean, there seems to be this information warfare, and it makes me question to what extent is this really part of that.
Thank you, Jyoti Puri. For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR.